T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
FM News Talk 97.1. On-demand audio.
Jim Talent, we're trying to guess, because we're all freezing in our studio, you're lucky to not be in here this morning. You're on the phone.
Yes. Well, you're freezing, huh? You know, the conversation brings back memories, because I was raised in a home that did not have air conditioning.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not... They used to build houses and position them on lots, you know, when there was no air conditioning, in a way that was designed to keep it a little cooler in the summer, you know, so to catch the winds in the right direction. I mean, things you could do. We had an attic fan. And now, there were some nights it was really hard to sleep, but you do get used to it. Now, of course, we have a problem if you have elderly people or the rest of it, you know, people who are vulnerable from a health standpoint, that's an issue. But you can get used to it being warmer than, you know, than you would think is necessary. So, very good.
Yeah,
and you're right. It does save money, and I'm not sure it is a little healthier, too.
I remember my wife's grandmother talking about sleeping outside in Forest Park in the middle of the summer many, many years, like back in the 1930s, just to kind of cool off and get out of their home that was baking hot in the summer heat. So,
we're lucky. Look, air conditioning is a great thing. We've got it. I sure don't want to give it up.
No,
but there are ways of living with somewhat higher temperatures on the hottest days.
So, what does the Talent household keep their thermostat at?
Yep.
About 72.
One degree off.
Close.
Smart man.
A little warmer. I mean, you know, it just depends. Part of it is we have two stories, so it depends a lot, and a basement. So, and part of the basement is finished. So it depends a lot on where you are, right? I mean, the lower you go, the cooler it is.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you can do is keep the thermostat a little higher, but then watch TV downstairs.
Yeah, no kidding.
When I watch TV downstairs, I need a big blanket.
Do I hear that, Denise?
Teeth are chattering.
Yeah, we're not gonna solve that debate. Sort of like we're not gonna solve the one in Washington right now, Jim. I'm anxious to get your take on some of the just outrageous reactions we've got in the last 24-48 hours to the President of the United States going to the scene of a major tragedy. That's something presidents have always done, and yet it's controversial when Donald Trump does it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the ongoing, we're now into the third year of the refusal to accept the fact that he's the president. And this is now, to be, I'm gonna try and bend over backwards to be fair. When you're in an era where there is no stable political equilibrium and the elections are very close, it tends to promote this kind of thing. Okay. I mean, the last five or six presidential elections, only one of them hasn't been close. You know, in the 2004 election, 150,000 votes change in Ohio and Kerry is, you know, is president. So that tends to promote this sort of thing. But what I don't like, I don't mind so much when the press is biased. I really don't. I used to tell the journalists, you know what, if I was in the press, I'd be biased. But I don't like it when they're not professional. I don't like it when they take cheap shots, like that question that they asked. That's a cheap shot.
Right.
I mean, that's a person who doesn't want to do the homework necessary to ask a more sophisticated and informed, if biased, question. You know, I mean, have enough respect for your own profession and your own reputation that you go a little deeper than something like that. It's just, it's a cheap shot, and they do it more than they used to. I think part of it is the economics of the, you know, of that, of journalism. I just don't think they can invest in enough in people who really become informed and are good. I mean, obviously there are exceptions to this, but it's, you know, it's a much bigger problem than it used to be.
Well, the shame of it is trying to just take every single thing out of context.
Yes.
The president talks about his concerns over illegal immigration. And therefore, you're talking about people who are coming into this country illegally, and the character or the criminal record of some of those folks. That doesn't mean that every single person who's Latino or Hispanic, because those are the majority of people coming across the southern border, are criminal. That's not what he said. It's never what he said. And yet that's kind of how they want to couch this argument, that somehow he's, you know, racist because he supports border security. It's insane.
Yeah, part of the problem they have is they want to attack what the administration is doing, when really all they're doing is trying to enforce the existing law. Now, the president did mention he'd like to see changes to make it more of a merit-based system, which other countries have, by the way, and countries that don't have it, like Britain, are talking very seriously about it. It's very responsible reform, and I would support something like that. But basically, most of what he's doing is enforcing the laws that have been on the books for a long time, and many of which, you know, most of which were passed with solid bipartisan support. So given that that's what his actual policy is, if you want to attack it, you almost have to do this cheap shot sort of stuff. They're the ones who are pushing for radical changes in how we approach immigration. I mean, we've argued in the past about how much immigration we should permit, how we should choose the people who can come in, but nobody's argued about the importance of enforcing the laws that we have, right? And they're doing that now. They're the ones who are trying to change the norm and the typical practice.
Yeah, we're talking to former Missouri Senator Jim Talent. One of the big headlines this morning, The Atlantic, USA Today, some of the big headlines are that a rare gun control proposal could unite Congress. Lindsey Graham is one of the ones pushing this. It looks like it would be something concerning red flag laws. And I know a lot of those are going to have to be passed at the statewide level.
Right.
But everybody's upset that it doesn't, that it might not include something more draconian like a assault weapons ban. What we have to do in this country, Jim, in my opinion, is figure out why 30 years ago there were just as many guns, they were all over the place, and we didn't have the same problems with these mass shootings that we're having today.
Yeah, well, I would say two things. First of all, the red flag laws are in the tradition of good policy regarding firearms, because in concept, what they're trying to do is to keep firearms out of the hands of people who, as a class, a narrow class, should not have access to them, and that we all agree should not have access to them, as unstable, violent people. That's why we don't let felons, I mean, everybody, convicted felons, we don't allow to have firearms. Now, many end up getting them illegally,
right?
But that's our policy. It's the same if you want to look at it in a different arena. It's why we may not allow people with a history of drunk driving to have driver's licenses, because as a class of people, we're concerned that they can't operate or won't operate automobiles safely, right? So this is a situation where the devil's in the details, and there's some really good testimony, those who want it, by David Koppel, who's with the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian institute. So they're very pro Second Amendment.
Right.
But he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on this, and you can get it. And he explained what the safeguards need to be in these kinds of laws for them to be good measures. And so I think it's intriguing, and I don't mind them pursuing it at all. The other thing, and I don't know if we have time to go into it, but we really need to harden these targets. And I think one of the ways to harden the targets is, and you can do this very responsibly, is to try and ensure and let these nuts know, let these evil people know, that there are going to be people on the premises who are themselves armed and who know how to use a firearm. Because if they know that, okay, they're going to skip that target. That's one consistent thing we've seen in all of these things. And I'd like to see schools and churches think about how to do that. And, you know, when you put up there's nobody in here has a gun, okay, you're kind of advertising that you're a soft target.
Yeah.
So, those are the kind of practical measures that you're obviously not going to pass a law requiring people to do that, but it's something that could be done on a voluntary basis.
I've pushed for it for a couple of years right here on this very program. And, the Governor Parson put together a task force, and one of their recommendations was making sure there was somebody in every school that had the ability to fight back in the instance like this. You saw it in Dayton. The police responded within 30 seconds. They shot the guy dead before he could cause any more problems. It's always better if you have a good guy with a gun there. And back to the mental health thing for a minute, though, Jim. The Connor Betts, we know, as far back as high school, put together a hit list on somebody. Nicholas Cruz, the guy in Parkland, Florida, was a minor at the time, but used to bring knives to school and used to talk about injuring other kids. Part of the problem we're going to face here with these red flag laws is that if you do something as a juvenile in this country, that record's pretty much sealed. It doesn't follow you into adulthood. We've got to carve out exceptions to problems like that. And if you've ever put together a hit list talking about killing other human beings, you should never be allowed to own a weapon.
Right. Well, and there's a danger of these laws being both under-inclusive, so not catching people like that, and also over-inclusive and being abused. Okay, so somebody's had a messy divorce and somebody makes a charge that you were violent, and then you for the rest of your life, you can't own a firearm. So, but a lot of this, and those who are saying that this is a drafting question are right. I mean, this is a question where, good legislators can have hearings and draft their way around these problems to try and ensure that the laws do what they're supposed to do. But again, this is the traditional kind of thing. This is good conceptually. It's approaching the problem from the right direction. It's saying, look, there are narrow classes of people who should not have access to this. This is why, we don't let people under 16 drive a car, right? Because we make a judgment that people who are too young should not be driving automobiles. Now, the 16, should it be 15 and a half or 16? People argue about that. But this class of legislation, I think, is intriguing and is appropriate to pursue. What doesn't work and what is wrong and what is counterproductive is to say, oh, okay, in response to this, there's automobile deaths as a result of drunk driving, so nobody can drive a car.
Right.
Or you have to pass, you have to be a specialist and go through, 10 auto driving courses to drive a car. No, it doesn't work, number one, and it inhibits important activity on the part of people, and it interferes with their rights.
Yeah, you can't get away from it. There was even an article yesterday, one of the, I believe it was CBS, went out and found some psychologist somewhere who was mad at the president for blaming mental health for some of these shootings. Yet, I'd love to talk to this person and say, how could you deny that each and every one of these people who would take a firearm and fire into a crowd of people is not mentally insane? They may not registered as such.
I interfere for the host. That's
radio. No. I'm just saying, I don't know how, even the smallest thing this president says or does, the media runs out to find somebody who says, oh, he's wrong for saying that. These people aren't mentally unhealthy. How, are you kidding me?
Yeah, most of them. Have significant mental health issues. I'm sure if you went back and looked at every one of them, they're all evil, right?
Right.
And even those who don't have significant mental health issues have often shown signs of very violent tendencies that we can pick up on. So empowering the people around them to do something about that is, again, a very plausible kind of policy change to pursue. Fixing the mental health, making the mental health system better in general would be a really, really good thing to do for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And therefore, we ought to be trying to do it. I don't think you can promise that any changes that a state, begins now are in the near future going to have significant impacts on this sort of thing, because that kind of global change takes years to accomplish, but it would be a good thing to do.
It absolutely does take a while, no doubt about it. Thank you very much. Jim Talent, we appreciate your thoughts on this, my friend.
Always good.
We'll talk to you next week. Former Missouri Senator Jim Talent.
Get more at 971talk.com.